I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome back to Radio Times. Next time you get a sore throat or sick to your stomach or have a strange rash, how about going online to talk with a doctor instead of calling for an appointment, driving to the office, and sitting in the waiting room before being seen? As texting and video calling become commonplace, more Americans are getting medical consults online, chatting with healthcare providers through their smartphones, tablets, or computers. Proponents say telemedicine can save a lot of money, make medicine more convenient, and increase access. But what about the doctor-patient relationship? How is that affected by telehealth care? Today on Radio Times, the pros and cons of cyber medicine. And joining us here in our Philadelphia studio is Carrie Kovarik. She's Associate Professor of Dermatology and Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, also Director of Telemedicine and Informatics for the Botswana and University of Pennsylvania Partnership. And Carrie Kovarik, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And joining us by telephone is Atif Mehotra, Associate Professor at the Harvard Medical School, a staff physician at the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, and a policy analyst at the RAND Corporation. His work is focused on access and cost. And Atif Mehotra, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me on, Marty.
Let me start with you, if I could, Atif, only because I want to make sure our listeners know what it is that we are talking about. How do you define what telemedicine is today?
You know, telemedicine covers, I think, a broad range of types of visits, any method of delivering care outside a face-to-face visit with a provider. So I think the one that's most familiar to people will be a video conference, so you'll over the internet, on your computer, or over a smartphone. But people, when they talk about telemedicine and telehealth, also include under that where you're messaging back and forth. I think many of your listeners are familiar with a personal health record where they can send messages to their doctor and the doctor can respond, as well as asynchronous visits where you might take a picture of a rash and send that to your doctor. So I think telehealth covers a relatively broad range of ways of getting care.
And can we include robots in that as well while we're talking, just to be inclusive?
I think, you know, in general, when we talk about telehealth, we mostly have been focused on ideas of, you know, having that provider-to-patient encounter outside a face-to-face visit. But I think there is a lot of interest also included in ways that computers and, I guess, robots even can provide care, though I think that's a couple decades away.
And Carrie, how much of your practice would you say involves some form of telemedicine? You have a practice in Philly, you've got a practice in some countries in Africa.
Currently, it's just a very small percentage, and mostly that's because of the reimbursement policies in the U.S. right now. In Pennsylvania, there isn't a great reimbursement for telemedicine, and so a lot of what I do is volunteer. We do have a program where we do telemedicine with the Philadelphia Health Centers and also some international telemedicine, so it's only about 10% of my practice.
And is that just that health insurance companies haven't caught up with this? Because I know under the Affordable Care Act, there's some pressure, some move to incorporate this as part of a practice.
That's correct. We're still waiting for it to catch up, and it just hasn't yet. I think what we want telemedicine to cover is more than what currently is in the healthcare market. So live telemedicine is certainly reimbursed more than store and forward telemedicine. Store and forward telemedicine is only reimbursed through Medicare in about 10 states, and Pennsylvania is not one of them.
And tell us what that means.
So asynchronous telemedicine, which was mentioned previously, is where you take a photo and send that to a provider and they review it later, rather than talking to someone live. And that's what we do more in dermatology. And so right now, because that's not reimbursed by Medicare, Medicaid, or most payers, our hands are a little bit tied in Pennsylvania and most states, whereas we feel that could really help a lot of the patients, especially under Obamacare, other patient providers.
Atif, is that a kind of a disconnect then between, I guess, what doctors and probably some patients want to do and our reimbursement system?
Yeah, there's a large amount of debate right now in the U.S. Congress about what we should do about payment policy for telemedicine visits. And maybe I just outline sort of the strengths and weaknesses. I think many telemedicine providers argue that the only way to encourage growth of these types of visits is for us to pay for them. And that's really, you know, in the typical way Medicare, a private health plan, would pay for a visit to a doctor's office. The concern is that that there will be overuse of telemedicine. In other words, you know, in medicine, when something becomes easier or better to use, we use it a lot more. And the concern is that this will be additional visits that weren't really necessary, really don't improve value or improve healthcare. And that's been the concern, given that healthcare spending is rising and, you know, is such an issue in our society.
Well, in fact, I, in doing some homework for today's show, I ran across, you know, Hypochondriac's Delight, that they could potentially overuse the system of teeth because a doctor is essentially just a click away, not just going online to a website, but an actual person is just a click away.
And I can address that a
sure,
little
go
bit.
Ahead.
We do mostly telemedicine from provider to provider, so not from patient to provider. And you're right, that can become an issue when a patient can directly access a doctor. But in our practice where providers send the consults, we haven't seen a tremendous uptake and overuse. We have about 100 clinicians in our Philadelphia health system. And because it takes the physician an amount of time to send a consult, they don't typically overuse it because it does take them time. They're not going to, you know, take all that time to send something that's unnecessary. So we haven't seen that overuse.
But Ativ, I'm wondering, I mean, and I read about some, you know, some companies, I guess, that are setting up computers and doctors or medical professionals to essentially answer people's phone calls. How common is that?
Yeah, no. So first, your listeners might have heard Teladoc is a company that just had an IPO, and they are themselves projected to offer about 500,000 visits. Those kinds of where either through a website or telephone, or they're about approximately about what people call direct to consumer telemedicine. There's about 1 million of those visits, and then some health systems have really embraced this way of delivering care outside the face-to-face visit. So if we were to go to California and look at the Kaiser system, they're projecting, I think this year, that we'll have a greater number of virtual visits than they will have in-person visits. And when they
really
say virtual visits, that what that means is either a visit over the telephone or the doctor and the patient are messaging back and forth. And so they've really focused a lot of energy and money in terms of trying to encourage their patients to access care that way as opposed to a face-to-face visit.
Go ahead, Carrie.
And I can kind of show the differences between those two systems. Within the Kaiser system, it's a closed system where patients typically get all of their health care within one system. And so the patients will be contacting their own doctors, and the doctors can actually triage them or say, yes, this is a condition, we want you to come in and see us, or no, we can take care of you through this telemedicine system. Sometimes in those direct-to-patient contexts like Teladoc, you're contacting a doctor that you've never seen before. So occasionally they don't have access to your records, and it can be a little bit disjointed.
Let me ask you how it works with you, because you're a dermatologist, and I don't know whether there's some specialties that are more amenable to this kind of technology, but how literally does it work for you?
So in our Philadelphia Health Center program, the doctors in the Philadelphia Health Centers will have, they can either use it through a computer or through their phone application. They'll open the application, enter the clinical history, take the photos of the patient, and press send. That information will be sent to us and all of us at the University of Pennsylvania Dermatology Department that's in that system will get an email alert that there's a case. We'll log on to the computer. Whoever picks up the case first will answer it, look at the information in the pictures and answer it, and it will go back to that clinician and they'll get an alert.
Do you feel like you have enough information by looking at a picture without having that patient sitting in your office and having some back and forth with them?
So our system's set up to have back and forth. We can actually say your photos are insufficient, we need more photos, we need more clinical information, and we can ask them for more information if we need it.
Ativ, I mean, is this it sounds like it's already here, but do you see this as becoming a bigger part of our healthcare system?
I think invariably so. I mean, just as technology has transformed so many areas of our lives from, you know, banking and others, I think it's invariable that this type of technology is going to really change the way healthcare is delivered. And I think it's going to be unclear exactly, as Carrie mentioned, some of the regulatory and payment policies, but also it's a little bit unclear exactly, there's lots of different flavors of telemedicine, and which are the ones that are really going to take off more than others is still something we're trying to figure out.
And I wonder, even let's say someone has a sore throat or something, I mean, should, I'll put this to you, Atif, should the patient, have a flashlight and shine the flashlight down their mouth and then take a picture and send it to their doctor? Is this a way that it can work?
Right now, Marty, this is happening. I think one of the things that's both exciting and also we're still grappling with is that patients now in 2015 have so many different options in terms of how to get care if they have a sore throat. It used to be go to your doctor's office or maybe go to the emergency department. Now you can call someone up on your smartphone and tell a doctor your symptoms. You can go to a retail clinic and go to an urgent care center. They have now services where people will come to your home. There's just really this convenience revolution in healthcare with lots of different options. And as we discussed before, a lot of people are now picking up their smartphone, pushing on that app, and within 15 minutes, a doctor's on the other side, and they're describing it. Now, obviously, with the back of your throat, it's going to be difficult for the doctor to see that, but any other aspect, you know, examining, say, a rash or other symptoms, they can use the video there to look at the patient.
And I would think dermatology, in many ways, would be very good for a system like this.
It is. The little bit sort of scary part about all of this is it's happening so fast, and it's happening faster than regulations are allowing, you know, to come out and say this is the good way to do it or this is the not so good way to do it. And so there's so many options out there, but we're unable to really tell patients which ones are the better ways to do it. We don't have great studies on all of these methods, and so patients are going out there and just picking the way they think is the best. And sometimes it's good and sometimes it's not.
Well, we're almost up in a break here. I mean, who hasn't gone online? You don't feel so well. You have some weird symptoms and you go online and go to a website. And on the one hand, they say it's probably okay. On the other hand, they say it could be a sign of cancer. I mean, it is sometimes hard to know if you're getting the right information.
Right. And sometimes you don't know who's on the other end. Some websites are very good about providing credentials of these providers, and some don't, and patients may or may not look at who that person is.
Well, we are talking about telemedicine, for lack of a better word, or perhaps that is the correct word, talking with Carrie Kovarik. She's Associate Professor of Dermatology and Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, also Director of Telemedicine and Informatics for the Botswana and University of Pennsylvania Partnership. We'll be talking about that as well. And joining us by telephone, Atif Mehrotra, Associate Professor at the Harvard Medical School, Staff Physician at the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, also a Policy Analyst at the Rand Corporation, and much of his work focused on things like access and cost. So what do you think about this way of going to the doctor? Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. A question for you next time you get a sore throat and or perhaps even a strange rash. How about going online for a checkup with a doctor instead of going to the doctor's office? And we're talking about some of the changes in our healthcare system and the role that online visits can have within our rather complicated and very expensive healthcare system. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. I'm curious, Carrie, you had mentioned some of the work that you're doing here with healthcare systems within Philadelphia. How about for some of these countries in Africa? Is it a similar kind of situation?
So it's a little bit different internationally, especially when some countries don't have any dermatologists. I'm a dermatologist, but certainly many specialists are visually based, and you can do telemedicine with other specialties, but I'll use dermatology as an example.
Sure.
In Africa, where I focus my work, the HIV epidemic was really when telemedicine for me got started, because there are so many skin conditions that come along with that issue. In 2007, I started a website where clinicians on the ground could send us telemedicine consults, and there are just very few dermatologists there. And so with HIV and skin conditions being common, we got many of these consults in that way.
And were you able to treat people and be able to diagnose and treat then?
So it started with very basic skin conditions coming our way because a lot of the healthcare workers were not trained in any kind of dermatology. And as we helped them with these conditions, they also learned a lot about skin conditions at the same time. So they became more educated, and then the consults became more difficult for me.
Oh, is that right? Why is that?
Because they learned about dermatology, and so they started sending the harder cases.
Gotcha.
Because they could handle those easy ones. And that's really what we want to do for any telemedicine system, is educate the clinicians but also help the patients.
And you were saying to me before going on the air that everyone, at least in Botswana, has a cell phone, or maybe more than one.
Exactly. So when I started in 2007, it wasn't the case, but over the last decade, they've really built up the cell networks, and it's enabled us to build cell-based telemedicine Wow. systems and really reach the rural patients through cell-based telemedicine.
And I wonder, Ative, in this country, and we've been talking about some more urban patients here, but the role that telemedicine can have with rural patients, where we know there aren't as many doctors, it takes longer to get to a hospital or to a doctor's office.
Yeah, no, I think for much of the attention and interest has been on the rural population. For example, Medicare right now focuses all its reimbursement policy on the rural population for many of the reasons you just mentioned, which is that, one, there are no providers locally available, or the providers are really far away, and, you know, the travel times are going to make it much more difficult. And for certain specialties, for example, mental health providers, there is no one in the county for a person to visit. So there's been a lot of interest in whether telemedicine can really expand access to care and give people in rural communities the same opportunities in terms of healthcare providers that those of us lucky enough to live in cities have.
Well, and I'm thinking about mental health services. So using something like Skype so that you can talk with a patient or have a regular contact with a patient?
Right. No, it's interesting. You know, Carrie's been focused obviously on dermatology given her specialty, but mental health has been probably the key area nationally in terms of where telemedicine is used for those patients who, especially those with serious mental illness, bipolar disease, schizophrenia, and you're living in a rural community in the Medicare population, this is an opportunity for you to access a psychiatrist in another city. And yes, via video conference.
Via video conference or some version of that. You had mentioned some concerns about cost, Ative, that if people have so much convenient access, they might overuse the system. And yet, I know some people are touting this as a way to reduce costs. And I think even under the Affordable Care Act, it's being promoted as a way to reduce costs. How do we weigh those?
Yeah, no, and I think that it's a difficult problem that we're having right now because of those two competing concerns that I described before. Certainly, telemedicine could save money if it replaces an in-person visit, in particular an in-person visit to an emergency department. There's a lot of it. I think that's driving those who see telemedicine as a way to save money. If you can have a $40 teledoc visit instead of having the person go to an emergency department where it costs $500 to $600 for that sore throat, that's obviously a lot of savings. The other side of that coin is that if those patients are now getting care when they otherwise would have stayed at home, potentially that could increase healthcare spending. And so that's the kind of yin and yang there.
Do you see the saying yin and yang, Claire?
Definitely. We definitely see that. And I think one place we really see that is inner city urban areas where there's a big access issue, not because they're far away from care, but because they can't get in to see care. And they definitely flow into our emergency rooms. And we see that in our Philadelphia health centers. And so I think that's one way we're trying to decrease emergency room visits by increasing specialty services in their home primary care doctor offices.
And I think a lot of people would say just even trying to get a regular doctor appointment these
right.
days is complicated. You often
yes.
can't see them the same day and have to drive, wait in line, park,
exactly.
get through traffic.
Yes. Exactly.
Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499 talking about telemedicine in this hour of Radio Times. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Kelly from Center Valley to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Kelly. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I actually just graduated from college, and one way I interacted with telemedicine was a couple times I had migraines that woke me up in the middle of the night, had to go down to student health, and they had nurses on staff overnight, but they didn't keep physicians on board, so a lot of times the nurses would have to call to authorize meds and stuff, but I remember that definitely saved me a couple trips to the emergency room, so it's something that I found to be useful.
Ative, make sense to you?
Yeah, no, I think definitely. I mean, I think that you see that option. I mean, one thing that we talk about, we talked a little bit about rural communities and being a place where telemedicine could be of appeal. Botswana is another example where you just don't have other providers. But we have to recognize that everybody in the United States is really struggling to get into care, as you already alluded to, long wait times and so forth. And it's interesting to see who is most likely to use telemedicine right now. It tends to be people who are more educated, a little higher income. I think that probably reflects their they feel more comfortable with the technology, but you also see a large fraction of people who aren't well plugged into the system with their primary care provider. For example, we did a study on Teladoc, and about one-fifth of the people who use Teladoc had had no healthcare use in the prior year.
Wow. Wow. So, I mean, on the one hand, people that are probably a little more well-heeled, able to access a system, and those who are kind of new to healthcare. Do you want to add to that, Kara?
It's really the convenience revolution, which I think we mentioned before. People want answers now. They don't want to have to wait. They don't want to have to go to a doctor. And like Ative said, they don't want to have to go somewhere where they're not used to. So finding a PCP, they'd rather just go online and find an answer quickly.
Ative, I'm curious about whether, you know, the doctor-patient relationship, does it exist? We'll start there. It's cracked up to be? I mean, I can understand under certain specialties or certain kind of care that's important. But I think, again, anyone who has a physician in a group practice, you don't always get your regular doctor.
Yeah, I think that there have been a lot of concerns, in particular from the primary care community, that a telemedicine visit, a retail clinic visit, any of these other alternatives is one less visit to the doctor and is going to disrupt that primary care relationship and have negative health consequences. But I think the data is just kind of showing that that's a thing of the past. The majority of people in the U.S., when they have a new problem and go get care, they are not seeing their primary care provider right now. They are seeing somebody else within the same practice or going to some other care site. So we're seeing that's already really shifted. And really to emphasize that, when we've talked to patients who have visited these other care sites, they've described to us that they're almost doing this internal triage in their mind. What I heard from one woman was, this is a problem I think I can go to this care site for, but if it was something more serious, I would be at my primary care doctor. So that's how I think somehow a way that patients are differentiating when they go to primary care and when they go to some other alternative.
Which tells you people are learning or know how to navigate our system to some degree. Ative, is that what you're saying?
Well, I think we don't know really because it puts patients, you know, that's what we're hearing from people, and that's a new role that we're putting people into, which is having to navigate the system and decide, this is a problem I can go to this care site for, and this is a problem I can go to another care site for. And it's a difficult task for patients, you know, a role for patients to play. There are these new online symptom checkers, which are websites that are trying to help people navigate the healthcare system and decide where they should get care. But even with those, I think it's a tough new role for patients.
Can you weigh in on this, Kara?
Yeah, I think it really depends on the patient. Like Ative said, the people that are really utilizing these services are people that haven't seen doctors, who they may not be on medications. They may have a very simple health history. For the patients that are on a lot of medications that have chronic medical conditions, this is going to get really complicated. They're seeing a practitioner that doesn't have their health history in front of them. Those are the patients that we worry a little bit about.
The fact that, I mean, that their needs are complicated.
They're complicated. The doctor may not know everything about their background. It just gets a little bit complex.
Let me see what Maxie from Morrisville has to say. Maxie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi. How are you doing?
Good.
I see the benefits of this program really being good. I mean, and primarily because for, I know a lot of people like myself who don't like to go to the doctor, the convenience of being able to go online and actually speak to a physician, I think for me, it could possibly save my life, you know?
Well, that's interesting. Maxie, are you saying you don't like to go to the doctor because you don't like to go to the doctor's office, or you just don't want to go see a doctor?
I don't like to sit in the office.
Wait
is excruciating. The filling out the, you know, the paperwork and, I mean, just that whole process is stressful.
I hear you, and you're not alone in that. I'm looking at you, Carrie.
Yeah, I mean, if there's someone that wouldn't go versus they'd call in and we could listen to their problem and, you know, hear some red flags and convince him to go see someone, you know, if there was something really wrong, that's a good thing. You know, I think finding some red flags and getting him to see a doctor by having him call in would be good.
And you know, we have some research coming out just in a couple of weeks that I think really hit upon what Max is describing, because when we talk about the healthcare system and we talk, you know, we measure costs, one thing we don't do is measure the costs, the time and the money that's related to that of going to the doctor's office. And so, and we try to quantify that in some work, and not surprisingly, there's a lot of time spent for each doctor's visit. On average, it's about 123 minutes that people spend either driving to their or getting to their doctor's office, and a lot of time spent in the waiting room waiting for their care. And that time translates into money, and we estimated that as a nation, we spend $50 billion of people's time and therefore money waiting for doctor's office visits. So it's a real drain on the system, and I think that's why there's also another aspect of this, of why there's interest in telemedicine, because it is so much more convenient and people can get care quickly and then move on with their lives.
And I think not necessarily just using telemedicine for care, but for triage. I think it's a huge asset for the healthcare system. We can first use it as a line of defense to see if the patient needs to be seen in person and save people time. Maybe the caller wouldn't need to be seen in person. We can save him that time, but maybe he does need to be seen in person and all those people don't need to come into the office.
Atif, just a quick question, and Maxie, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Who is on the other end? Is it physicians? Is it physicians within a specialty? Is it nurses? Who's on the other end there?
Yeah, so for right now, when we talk of, we're talking about so many different flavors of telemedicine.
Yes, we are.
In terms of the, what we're talking about, the direct-to-consumer telemedicine, where you, again, you pick up your smartphone or go to the internet and get a physician, a physician online who usually comes on within 10, 15 minutes. It has to be someone who's board certified and someone within your own state, who's licensed in your state is who can provide care that way.
And it looks like I half stole our caller's question. This is Mira from Elkins Park, and go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Yeah, I was wondering about the credentials of the people who are on these apps online, and also if someone in alternative medicine or a doctor could open up their own practice just, you know, online or on this app.
And by alternative medicine, Muriel, what do you mean by that?
Like naturopathic doctors or Chinese medicine practitioners, things like that.
Sure, sure. Let me toss that first to Carrie.
Yeah, and I can expand on what Atif just said. So there are apps. I can talk about dermatology. There are good dermatology apps where they are board certified American physicians. There are also ones where they're not board certified American physicians, and there's ones where you can pay less money to get a PA who is in an emergency room.
A
physician assistant. So you need to look and see who's actually providing the care to you. And in certain states, the laws are different. So you have to be practicing within the scope of your practice. So whoever you are, you have to be doing what you're certified to do I don't know if Atif knows about the alternate care providers.
I'd be curious about that. Atif, go ahead.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't know. I haven't, you know, I've been so focused on the medical, you know, the physician side that I don't know if there are a lot of alternative care providers. But just to echo what Carrie said on the physician and other, PAs and so forth, it is a bit of the Wild West out there. There are a lot of companies that are emerging very quickly to provide this care. And so it's an overwhelming set of options.
I'm curious, too, whether, Atif, if you've looked at this, whether doctors, let's use doctors, prescribe or treat differently if they're doing it via teleconference versus in the office.
Yeah, there's been a lot of concerns about that specific point, which is, you know, I can't physically, the physician can't physically examine the patient and therefore is going to be more apt to prescribe antibiotics just to be on the safe side, if you, that mentality. We've done a couple studies on that and we've kind of had mixed findings. In one study where we looked within the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, we found that primary care physicians who are providing e-visits were slightly more likely to prescribe antibiotics. But then we've just published some work on TeleDoc where we found that the TeleDoc physicians were just as likely to prescribe antibiotics as a face-to-face visit with a primary care physician. I think the one caveat to that I might say, Marty, is that unfortunately saying you're equal to an in-person visit may be not the best measure of quality in the sense that we do have a problem in the U.S. healthcare system as a whole, in-person visits, telemedicine visits, of overuse of antibiotics. So I think that's just a bigger issue that we have in the healthcare system.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about virtual checkups, telemedicine, and the voice you just heard is Atif Mehotra, associate professor at the Harvard Medical School, staff physician at the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, and a policy analyst at the RAND Corporation. And here with us in our Philadelphia studio is Carrie Kovarik, Associate Professor of Dermatology and Medicine, and that's at the University of Pennsylvania here in Philadelphia, Director of Telemedicine and Informatics for the Botswana and University of Pennsylvania Partnership. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. We've got a lot of people that want to join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about cyber medicine, telehealth care. And again, our guests are Carrie Kovarik and Atif Mehotra. And we got a lot of people that want to join the conversation. Let me get Ben from Princeton to join us. Hi, Ben. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call.
You're very welcome.
I've used telehealth in the past, and I'm a huge fan of it. I will continue to use it. One comment that I have is I find all these startups that come up, they're a little too expensive because when you kind of add on the cost of what you're already paying for healthcare, it just gets a little too expensive. But my question is, you live in a day and age where your personal information, whether it's at retail or financial institutions, is getting stolen left, right, and center. Now you're basically putting your health information on apps or on your mobile phone. So for all those startups that are launching in telehealth, how do they mitigate that risk from a consumer point of view and make people like me who want to use telehealth feel secure that the information is going to be safe?
Ben, it's a great question. I'm going to toss that first to Atif. And what do you say back to Ben?
You know, I think certainly that has been a huge concern. A lot of effort and has been put into trying to protect that information from encrypting the information and also reassurances from the telemedicine companies that they will keep everything HIPAA compliant. But I think that given an era where we're seeing almost on a daily basis some company get hacked into and have their information released, I think there are a lot of concerns out there that our information could be made available. Though I would also unfortunately emphasize that we also see healthcare systems being hacked into and their information being taken and from insurance companies. So it is a big problem.
Yeah, Carrie, I'm looking at your face here. I mean, this is an issue we're all having to deal with.
It is. I mean, the companies do the best they can. I think what you can do is when you decide to go with one company, look on their site, make sure they're secure, HIPAA compliant, encrypted. Some sites look better than others. Just, you know, do your due diligence and do the best you can to find a good site to go with.
And are you saying it'll be obvious? I mean, if you look at it, there should be some flags to tell you this is not a particularly secure site.
Well, I recently published a study on a review of the direct-to-consumer dermatology sites, and I can tell you some of them are definitely more professional than others. The better ones post all of the credentials of the physicians. Mm-hmm. They talk about their security, their encryptions, and the ones that I probably wouldn't recommend don't do so.
Atif, is there an issue of liability or even malpractice or the problems or the potential problems of misdiagnosis with telemedicine?
I think there are, and I think that's one of the areas that we don't know a lot about in terms of how there has been some research, I don't want to deny that, in terms of how comparing telemedicine versus an in-person visit. But I think given how quickly it's growing, I think there's still a lot that needs to be done on evaluating how well a provider can diagnose. And one area that we've been documenting in some of our research where a particular concern is the ability to provide tests. So, you know, if you go to a doctor's office, you go to the emergency department, they can quickly order any blood tests, other tests that are necessary. But when you see someone via a telemedicine visit, that is a key barrier. And, for example, with a person coming in with a sore throat, we argue that using a rapid strep test is a quick way of figuring out whether they have strep throat or not. But if you see someone via telemedicine, it's much more difficult, and because of that, telemedicine doctors are much less likely to order that test. So I think that's an area of potential for misdiagnosis.
Yeah, how do you deal with this? And I don't know if dermatology is different because of how visual it is.
So one reason why we prefer to do provider-to-provider telemedicine is because we like to be able to see these patients in person if needed. And we do this within a system where we feel comfortable recommending that in-person visit. So if we can't be comfortable making that diagnosis through telemedicine, we have them come into the office. We may need a biopsy. We may need blood work. But we are able to do that.
But what I hear you saying is the way that you and others do it, part of your system, is provider to provider.
Right.
So you've got two providers, I guess, on either side.
Exactly. So that we can do ancillary tests if needed.
And Atif, we've been, you know, toggling back and forth between something like that and also systems that allow a patient direct access to a physician.
Right. And right now we're seeing, you know, in some sense, patients are voting with their feet by their phones.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe they're right
now. No more feet, yes.
where they are, you know, really going to direct-to-consumer telemedicine in bigger and bigger numbers. I think I mentioned earlier, estimates are about 1 million visits this year via that form. So, and we're seeing patients go to other care sites like retail clinics and urgent care centers. They're looking for alternatives right now. And so I think that's really where the growth is.
And are people paying out of pocket? Is it covered by insurance? Does that vary from state to state, Atif?
Yeah, so you're seeing a lot of insurance companies start to cover telemedicine visits. For example, Aetna, if you have that insurance, they'll cover a teledoc visit. Anthem Health Insurance has started their own video visits called Live Health Online, and those are growing rapidly. So a lot of insurance companies are reimbursing for those visits and, in some cases, actually creating financial incentives with lower co-payments if patients will use those versus going to another care site.
Is there a gold standard for you, Carrie?
I think the important thing to know is that there needs to be a place for those patients to go if they need to be seen in person, no matter how they are, you know, covered. So even if they're seen by direct-to-patient care and they need testing or they need to be seen in person, there needs to be somewhere for them to go besides just their local emergency room.
I mean, a place that's connected to these teledocs, for instance?
Whether it's to their PCP or a clinic, yeah.
We have Annette joining us from Eagleville. Annette, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi. This is Annette. And I have not participated in telemedicine, although I would like to. And one of the reasons I would like to do it is because as a very frequent patient during the past few years at both my primary care physician's office and numerous specialists, every time I go to the primary care's office, I have to get weighed, and I have to wait for pretty much of an extended period of time. And I'm a thin person, but I really find it offensive as a woman to have someone insist to me that I get weighed every time I walk in their office. And if I could just do a teleconference, I would do that immediately. I would immediately choose that option because I don't have to wait for that, presumably, and I also don't have to get weighed. And
I hear
you. I know plenty of people who go to minute clinics and avoid primary care offices altogether because they don't want to get weighed.
Okay, well, let me take your point and another point you made, Annette, which is that you have been a frequent user of the system. And Atif, if I can toss that to you, is that what telemedicine is kind of designed for, people like Annette? I mean, beyond not wanting to get weighed, I can relate to that, but nonetheless, someone that is a more frequent user of the system.
Yeah, actually, maybe in contrast to that, many of the people who are going to these different care options are actually those who are not having to go to their primary care doctor. So if you would almost split up the population into those who have been visiting their doctors a lot, who have chronic illnesses or other reasons to see, those patients generally preferentially are going back, continue to see their doctor. And it's those others that are, generally healthy, haven't had a lot of encounters with their primary care provider that are preferentially using these new options.
Go ahead, Carrie.
The other thing that would be nice is if some of these primary care doctors had incentives to do telemedicine and triage patients so that Annette could actually do telemedicine with her own PCP. But right now, there's no incentives for that, and there would be continuity there.
We were talking off the air, Carrie, and you were saying, if there is a gold standard in the United States, California, at least from your perspective, would be the state.
In terms of reimbursement, they have good reimbursement for teledermatology, both through Medicare and Medicaid, or through Medicaid, I'm sorry, not Medicare, but through Medicaid. They reimburse for teledermatology through the asynchronous or store and forward teledermatology. And there's about 10 states that do that, and that's what we're looking for in Pennsylvania.
Let me get Tom from Ocean City, New Jersey, to join us. Tom, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you, Marty. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
My question lies, again, with the liability. I myself am not a med student, so how do I know that a symptom that I bring up is not, how do I know that a symptom that I have and I just brush off like, oh, I have a stomachache in addition to a sore throat, but I'm more concerned about the sore throat and don't tell the person on the other end about the stomachache and the doctor could misdiagnose a sore throat, mono, as just a sore throat, in a case like that.
Well, Tom,
what's the liability like?
Well, Tom, let me put that to Atif. It's not like, and I'm thinking of Tom's example, I mean, even in a doctor's office, people don't always explain everything correctly, if you know what I mean.
No, I think, first, the liability concerns an issue, but just to echo what you just said, Marty, the same issue could have happened, and we see that as practicing physicians where patients, we either forget to ask the question or the patient doesn't volunteer the information, for example, in Tom's case about the stomach pain. And we know that, unfortunately, in healthcare, misdiagnosis is relatively common. The Institute of Medicine is doing some work, and I think the estimates are about 10 to 15% of diagnoses are misdiagnoses in healthcare, and that's in-person visits. That people are talking about. I think the concern is that misdiagnosis rate higher with telemedicine? We don't really know the answer to that question. We've done some work where we've looked at whether people are more likely to have a follow-up visit after a telemedicine visit versus an in-person visit. And the idea there is that if you got misdiagnosed, the person would go back and get another visit. We don't see higher rates of follow-up visits, but that's a pretty crude measure of that. And I just to sort of echo what Tom's saying, and I think that's something we really need to be focused on.
I mean, even with dermatology, Carrie, there's something about just seeing someone in the flesh in your office.
Right, and there's been many studies on teledermatology concordance. It was one of the first specialties that started doing studies where someone in person saw the rash and someone saw the rash in pictures, and they gave their opinion, and they were very concordant. So we've been looking at this many years.
Tom, thanks for the call. Let me see what Michelle from Philadelphia has to say. Hi, Michelle. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Do we have Michelle? Yeah, go ahead, Michelle.
Yes. Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, indeed. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Thanks, Marty.
Sure.
I'm an emergency doctor from the area, and I've been basically asked multiple times from different telemedicine providers to come on board, and I'm always very apprehensive. I see many of my friends actually taking jobs with various providers, and there's a lot of companies that are opening up in Philadelphia area, too. And I have a couple main concerns, one being, you know, this is just, I think it was born for cost. So therefore, mm-hmm. the only reason it was created was to keep costs down, and it's being sold as convenient. So now we have another thing that, you know, doctors are supposed to look at the screen. Patients are expected to kind of get their answer right away. And it's kind of another thing that's put on our back, like, hey, we're supposed to immediately now look at a screen and know what you have. It's hard enough to have that responsibility when we're touching you, feeling you, spelling you, with you, but now we have to look at a screen, and I feel like we're just really go the wrong way.
Well, Michelle, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me see what Ativ has to say. I mean, her concerns is that perhaps we're focusing on, or telemedicine is focusing on the wrong things, cost and convenience.
You know, I mean, it's an interesting question. I mean, I think to first to emphasize the point, what's driving this growth in telemedicine? And there are a lot of reasons for it. We talked about the access, but it is also that as a society, we are moving to a place where we expect our grocery stores to be open 24 hours a day, our banking to be open 24 hours a day. And not surprisingly, I think that people are looking for more convenient healthcare or more timely healthcare. What maybe, I don't know, several generations ago would be reasonable for your doctor to say, wait a couple days and come in to see me. I don't think a lot of the listening audiences, that's acceptable to them right now. But I think it does have some, it's a healthcare system that has to respond to where society is moving, which is for more, I don't know, instantaneous care.
Go ahead, Carrie.
In our Philadelphia program, which is in 10, all 10 Philadelphia health centers, which are our low-income centers and 4 HIV clinics that are associated with Penn, is totally a volunteer program. It's to increase access for patients who wouldn't otherwise have dermatology care. We've diagnosed melanomas, sarcomas, patients with near-fatal drug reactions. And we're just really trying to provide access to these patients. That's really all that program is for.
And we're almost out of time here. Ativ, I mean, is the goal, I mean, obviously you want to provide good care, but to keep people out of the emergency room that really shouldn't be there, but also to keep them out of the doctor's office to some degree?
No, I think it'll be really interesting to see where we head as a healthcare system. My suspicion, and I don't know, is that really Kaiser, the example that I propped before, which was that if we were to fast forward, you know, several decades from now, I think that the norm won't be in-person visits with your doctor, but, you know, what Kaiser is doing with these virtual visits, whether it's going to be by video, telephone, or messaging back and forth. And so I think that the number of in-person visits will likely go down to some degree.
And your thoughts as you look into your crystal ball, Carrie?
I really hope that telemedicine goes more to a triage program where we see patients, you know, and the ones that need to come into the office come into the office, and we avoid visits for patients that don't need to be seen to save them time and money, and just see the ones that need to be seen.
I mean, sort of that's the first contact, and then from there,
figure out.
Might be okay or you might need to come in.
Exactly.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Ativ Malhotra, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And he's associate professor at the Harvard Medical School. Carrie Kovarik, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
And she's associate professor of dermatology and medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. A lot of interest in this topic, as we can see. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can download a podcast of the show. You can listen to us on satellite radio, channel 122. You can find us on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter. Appreciate all those phone calls today on Radio Times. Claire Moran, our intern this summer. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.